fairly common when you meet someone. Sometimes you'll ask what it is that they do. We're curious about our work and where we put our focus and where our time is committed to. In my case, because I'm a minister, when somebody usually asks me that question, they'll often say, well, what church? And interesting, when I say United Church of God, they always assume it's right on the corner. That just sounds generic. When I said Worldwide Church of God, they go, what is that? And when I say I went to Ambassador College, they go, what kind of college is that? But when I say United Church of God, they figure, well, I'm right down there in the corner. It usually satisfies the request. But still, when I get to know someone and they know I'm a minister, then they'll usually follow up at some point and they'll say, well, what is it that makes you different from other churches? What is it about you that would represent you in a specific way? And so I've answered that question differently over the years at different times. But fundamentally, I say that we recognize both the Old and the New Testaments, both for history and for doctrine, that we do not loose what God has bound, and we do not bind what God has loosed. I think, frankly, that's almost an in-house description. Probably that means more to us than someone that I would mention that to. I say it in more of the vernacular for them. But I say effectively that we're striving to obey God the way He tells us to. And in the Bible, if He tells us to do something, we do it. And then if in the Bible He shows us that we no longer have to, then that is complete. But as long as He gives us those instructions, that is what we do. Think about how much of what we understand comes from the Old Testament. You know, some churches think or feel and believe that they're, in that sense, a New Testament church. But think about what we believe and understand and how much of it comes from the Old Testament. If you were to say, well, I want to illustrate the Ten Commandments, where are you going to go? They're in the New Testament, but you'd have to kind of piece them together and you'd have to find places where they're mentioned. But in the Old Testament, they're codified. And the fact is, if we wanted to illustrate God's instruction that way, we would go to the Old Testament. If we wanted to illustrate the place where the holy days were all mentioned in a package, where you could see them in relationship to each other, you'd go to the Old Testament. You would turn there immediately. If you wanted to give instruction, and instruction on tithing, where it shows that there are ways in which God has used intentionally to take care of the finances of His church and His people, you'd go to the Old Testament. If you wanted to show and explain what it is that we should eat and what it is that we should not eat, the same thing. As I began to simply look through doctrinal matters, things that we commonly believe and understand, what you and I take for granted because this is what we do in cases for decades. These are the things we've done. But the place where that is first addressed and laid out and explained is oftentimes the Old Testament. When Christ came, bringing the gospel of the kingdom of God, and began to open up then access to the Holy Spirit, and we have the gospel accounts, and then we have the apostles teaching what Christ had given them. But again, it all pointed back in many ways. If we were just to go to the book of Genesis, and we started walking through the book of Genesis, you'd start out in showing how the Sabbath day was sanctified, set apart for God's holy purposes of creation. You'd go a chapter later and you'd see how sin was introduced into Adam and Eve's lives and then their children. You'd go back into the flood and you'd see that even at the time of Noah, clean and unclean was already in place. Many times when I end up answering questions about what it is that we do believe, it surprises me, frankly, how much I go back to show where those things began. The calling of Abraham, Genesis 12. The covenant that was made with Abraham and the promises to his descendants, which has an enormous impact on what we see having played out over all these thousands of years and even what plays out now today. Chapter 15, chapter 17. Tithing in the time of Abraham. Blessings on the descendants of Abraham. You have to go back to the Old Testament. If you wanted to explain to somebody how Satan sinned and what his attitude was and what began there and how he contended with God, you'd go to Isaiah or you'd go to Ezekiel. If you wanted to explain about blessings and cursings, how God says, if you obey me, I'll bless you. If you oppose me, I will curse you. I will oppose you. You'd go back to Leviticus. You'd go back to Deuteronomy. If you wanted to explain why we don't keep Christmas and why we do keep the holy days, you'd probably go to Jeremiah 10, and then you'd go to Deuteronomy 12. Now, the New Testament all follows through and builds on this base, but again, you would go back to those scriptures that show where these things began. If you wanted to show the Feast of Tabernacles being kept on the earth after Christ's return, you go to Zechariah. We're going to constantly go back to those issues. The lion and the lamb, you go to Isaiah. The plowman and the reaper, you go to Amos. The swords being beat into plowshares that you have in front of the United Nations building, you'd go back to Micah. Again and again and again, we would go back to the Old Testament. If you wanted to show that Israel was to be returned to its land and restored, you'd probably go to Ezekiel. Many of the prophecies of the end time, indeed, the ones that we're watching today to see if indeed they're going to fall into place as we watch, we'd go many times to Daniel. And then we'd go to Revelation. So time and time again, we go back to the Old Testament. If you took that out of our Bibles and gave us the truth of the New Testament only, it'd be like turning on the TV in the middle of a movie. Here are the cowboys, they're riding across the desert. Somebody's coming up behind and chase him. And you go, well, which one's the good guys and which ones are the bad? Which ones robbed the stage and which ones are trying to recover the loot? You don't know because you didn't see what had taken place. And so with the Old Testament, so many times, we have illustrations, we have symbolism that we don't abandon as we go forward into the new. We still see it unified in many ways together. The symbolism of the holy days and the meaning of this day specifically is much the same. Israel did not look at the days of unleavened bread the way we do. The symbolism that we are accustomed to is from the New Testament. Leavening as a portrayal of sin is a New Testament symbol. It did not come from the old and is not the way Israel looked at those things. We not being puffed up, as Paul was addressing in 1 Corinthians 5, is again from the New Testament. And the fact that we are indeed unleavened in this way, again, all ties together. Obviously, I believe the portrayal of sin in regard to leavening, in regard to the days of unleavened bread in the New Testament, is the fundamental symbol that we have been given. But if we will go back and look at these days from an Old Testament perspective, then there is a lesson there to learn as well. If we look at these days as much as maybe we can, as God would have had Israel to do so, I believe there's additional lesson for us there as well. Look at Deuteronomy 16. Now, Greg had just addressed, maybe a week ago, but recently, material in Deuteronomy 16 in terms of the Passover and the days of unleavened bread and the terms that are used there and why the explanation is such as it is. I don't want to go back over and readdress any of that, but I do want to go to verse number 3. You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it, that is, the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. The bread, what is the bread of affliction? How many vote for Rye Crisp? We think of unleavened bread in terms of maybe the bread of affliction in a context of maybe, well, it wasn't pleasant. The bread wasn't pleasant. It wasn't the way it could have been. That has nothing to do with it at all. How many of us eat better during the days of unleavened bread than we eat the rest of the year? I mean, most of us do. Megan made her cheesecake again, and we were coming back from the dinner last night with what was left of this macadamia nut coconut cheesecake in the car, passing it around in the car, eating down this unleavened coconut crust that was spectacular. I mean, it's an upgrade. When we get to the days of unleavened bread, I think in terms of how delicious all of these blessings and opportunities are going to be, and all the little things we make and the pastries and set them out. I mean, you have to literally limit yourself. It's not affliction. The bread itself is wonderful. When we lived in Texas, one of the ladies down there at that time, Lucy Brown, lived north of Lubbock, and every Days of Unleavened Bread, and I would visit through the year. Her son was paralyzed and shut in there at the house, and I would be a regular visitor at their place. But every Days of Unleavened Bread, she'd kind of give me a call and say, "Come on up, I'm making popovers." And she'd make trays of these popovers, and I'd eat half the tray. I mean, they were spectacular, and they weren't leavened. And it was an upgrade from what normally would have been. And so the affliction that is being addressed here is not a reference to rye crisp. It's not a form of punishment in terms of what we eat. It's a reference to what it symbolized to Israel back then. And again, there's a lesson that can be learned from it. You shall eat, here, the bread of affliction. One, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste. That's part of the lesson. Because they came out of the land of Egypt very quickly, and the bread was not leavened, but that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. They were to remember that they were afflicted and that they were delivered quickly and in haste, and for the rest of their life, they were to remember the contrast to what it was like to have been in Egypt and what it should be like to serve God. There was a contrast that should have been dramatic in their minds. If we go through Deuteronomy 16 and we start to look at the holy days as they were presented here, and we compare that then to the Days of Unleavened Bread, you're going to see a contrast. And I want to show you that in a specific way. Verse 13, start with the Feast of Tabernacles, and we'll work backwards from there. But in verse 13, you shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you've gathered in from your threshing floor and from your winepress. Rejoice in your feast, you, your son, your daughter, your servants, the Levites, the strangers. Basically, everybody there is to rejoice. Verse 15, 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast. Sacred here in the Hebrew is a reference to activities that are solemn and important and significant, as in marching, moving, or even dancing, if you go back and look up that particular term. It just says that your activities of this feast should be very meaningful and specific to what you are representing here. A sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you shall surely rejoice. And so there's a very specific instruction here that it's going to be a time of joy and pleasure and excitement in a very important and specific way. The Tanakh says you shall have nothing but joy, referring to the Feast of Tabernacles. In that specific way, obviously, it's not a time of mourning. Now, we don't have the same kind of introspection that you would have, say, coming into the Passover. Go backwards now to Pentecost, verse number 9. You shall count 7 weeks for yourself. Begin to count the 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the grain. And so, obviously, if we're going to be counting weeks to Pentecost, the only way in the Bible that we're ever given to count weeks is from Sabbath to Sabbath, and you count by sevens, and it's seven sevens, so Pentecost has to then follow on the Sunday, because you're counting by weeks, and it portrays the Sabbaths, the sabbaticals, and the Jubilee. It says, then you shall keep the Feast of Weeks to the Lord, your God, with a tribute of a freewill offering from your hand, which you shall give as the Lord your God blesses you. Then he says, you shall rejoice before the Lord your God. You and your son, your daughter, your manservant, your maidservants, the Levites, and it goes on, and it reminds us again that this is something for all of us to do, but it says, you shall rejoice. Now, when we go through some of the rest of the symbolism here, again, when we're going into the Days of Unleavened Bread, it says to eat the bread of affliction. And we don't have a command built into the Days of Unleavened Bread to rejoice in the same way. Now, the night to be much observed is obviously a rejoicing. That's a specific area that is specifically mentioned. But when you go through the symbolism here, the command to rejoice is just not there. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't rejoice, but I'm saying that one of the lessons is different than simply the abundance and simply the joy that we associate with the fall festival season. That there is a different lesson here that we should learn. Verse number 4, we have this instruction going through here. No leaven shall be seen among you in your territory. Going on down to verse number 8. 6 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the seventh day there shall be a sacred assembly to the Lord your God. You shall do no work in it. The word sacred here is a little different. It means restraint. And in this case, being a holy day, it is a restraint from our labor, our normal work week efforts at that time. But again, there is no specific command here on this package of days to rejoice in that same way. The bread, verse 3, chapter 16, that was unleavened, the bread of affliction, was unleavened, again, because God brought Israel out of Egypt in haste. They were in bondage, and he set them free, and they were to remember for the rest of their lives what that affliction had been like, and what it was like to serve God, what it should have been like. I brought vines with me today, and I looked up the word on affliction. And I want to express some of the words that are used to translate affliction. In one case, it's poor and weak, and it's a reference to a person. A person who's afflicted or afflicting is a poor, weak person. It's a person who has been humbled, brought down in that respect. To be humbled and to be afflicted is the way the word is used in another place. It says, the word common to both ancient and modern Hebrew is the source of several important words in the history and experience of Judaism. Humble, meek, poor, and affliction. The word often expresses harsh and painful treatment. Sarah dealt hardly or afflicted Hagar. When Joseph was sold as a slave, his feet were hurt or afflicted with fetters. And so the reference here is in that context. Frequently, the verb expresses the idea that God sends affliction for disciplinary purposes. The Lord your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you, to prove you, and to know what was in your heart. Especially in latter Israelite history, just before the exile and following, the noun, there's a verb form and a noun form, the noun came to have a special connection with those faithful ones who were being abused and taken advantage of by the rich. And so the word, the bread of affliction, is a reference to Israel's bondage in Egypt, that they were enslaved, brought low, humbled, cast down, and taken advantage of. And so the bread of affliction was God's remembrance for them, that they would know whereof they had come from, that God had interceded on their behalf and brought them out quickly to serve him. And they were supposed to recognize a dramatic contrast between the two. Have you ever done something and you said, oops, that was a mistake, and then you went around and did it again? Have you ever made the same mistake twice? Or is it just me? Back in 1969 BC, which is 1969 before I was converted, but 1969 BC, I was out with some friends and we'd had a couple of drinks, just a couple, and we were going someplace where we could get a couple more, and I pulled my car into the parking lot, and there was a building to the back of this establishment that we were going to for a couple more drinks, and I pulled up, and there was just grass, tall grass in front of the building. And so I pulled my car up, and I pulled up right to the building, and slam! And I couldn't believe it, and I backed the car up, and I looked, and there was just tall grass there. And the building, and so I pulled up and hit it again. Now, What it was there's one of these big steel posts that was there where you're supposed to park, and the grass had grown up all around it. But I drove up and slammed into this post. I looked back, and I couldn't see it, so obviously it wasn't there. So I pulled up and hit it again. Sometimes we do that, brethren, in different ways. Sometimes we do that with our jobs. Sometimes we do that in our relationships and on our families. Sometimes we do that with our finances. We make the same mistake again. That's what Israel did over and over and over. They made the same mistake again. God says, look, you were in bondage. You were under affliction. I have redeemed you. I have brought you to me. And I have done this and brought you out quickly. And this bread of affliction that didn't have time to rise, I want you to remember that I brought you out of Egypt and the bondage that was there. I want you to remember that suffering has a purpose, and that we should learn a lesson by suffering, and that it should impact the way we then make our choices and live our lives. We should learn indeed by those things in which we are humbled. Numbers 11 is an account of Israel complaining their way across the wilderness. Numbers 11, verse number 1. It says, when the people complained, it displeased the Lord. For the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused. So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. So God sent a warning, says, don't do that. This is wrong. This will hurt you. This will keep you from being blessed. And he sent a fire, and it consumed some around the edge of the camp. And the people cried out to Moses. And when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. And in that sense, you'd have a chance to say, okay, I don't want to do that again. I'm not going to do that again. And in verse 3, so he called the name of the place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord had burned among them, and that means burning. Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. And what is intense craving? I mean, that is lust of in a refined form, intense craving. So the children of Israel again wept and said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Israel began to look back at their bondage, and it began to look like it was a blessing and an opportunity. And they began to see what God had given them, the manna, as a curse. Their opinion and their focus began to change. He says, now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. They saw their blessings as a curse, and they saw their previous curses as blessings. So God determined here to give them meat, to give them quail. Verse 31 describes how abundant that was and how incredible God provided in this respect. He says, now a wind went out from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near the camp, about a day's journey on this side and about a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp and about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground. And the people stayed up, and they went out to harvest these quail. It says the people stayed up all that day, all that night, all the next day. And it said, and gathered the quail, and he who gathered least gathered 10 homers. A homer is about 6 bushels. And so the person who gathered the least, the laziest bum in Israel, gathered 60 bushels of quail. Can you imagine? You know, people coming in off of the land, the desert there with front-end loaders and stuff, you know, dumping the quail by the tent, going back out. I mean, just hauling this in by the dump truck almost. Somehow or other, it doesn't appear that they had learned much of a lesson here in terms of their intense lusting. They began to fuss and complain. They began to look at what was a blessing as a curse, and a curse indeed as a blessing. So he called the name of the place, translated here, the graves of craving, for those, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving. So again, everybody didn't die here, But there were individuals who simply lost their focus, and God punished them again. Brethren, God called Israel out of bondage to freedom. And at some point in time, Israel began to see their bondage as freedom and their freedom as bondage. They simply didn't keep their focus in place. There are times when we suffer, when we have affliction, and we begin to see it indeed as bondage, when indeed it's actually for our good. It's so that God, because in His love for us, He's protecting us, or so that we will be humbled, or so that we will draw ourselves down and submit ourselves to Him. The bread of affliction, brethren, is a blessing. It is a reminder that God has brought us out of our bondage and brought us to Him. When Megan was being born, we, as our first child together, that we had, because I have my son previously and older, but in our marriage, our first child was Megan. And as we approached that time, we had a good friend of ours who was a doctor, and we wanted him to do the delivery because we knew he would do what we wanted. And we were very careful and picky about that whole process. You know, your first child has to be natural, it has to be right, and all the. So we had a contract with the hospital. Here's what you can do, here's what you can't do, here's what we want, here's what we're trying to accomplish. We were going to do anything we could avoid because sometimes the C-sections are a little too readily used for sake of convenience and timing. We wanted to avoid all of those things. And so we spent a lot of time talking to our doctor, laying out this contract, talking to the hospital, making sure that everything would be just right. Well, about 6 hours into labor, hard labor, no baby is delivered, and pretty soon you're going, well, this is rather strenuous here, but we're going to stick it out. And then about 12 hours into labor, and Michelle's holding my ears basically with her face right into my face so that she could keep her focus, I'm beginning to say, you know, somebody take that contract and get it out of here, you know. And then, you know, it goes on and on. Pretty soon we had walked through this. I had no idea what a woman went through in the wilderness without medical care when she went into labor and the baby didn't deliver. I had no concept. I could understand how a woman could die from childbirth. When you begin in labor and the child doesn't deliver and the labor just goes on and on, the woman would simply go to the point of physical exhaustion and die. And women died out on the wagon trains and out by themselves without that kind of intervention and care available to them. And it was the first time that I could understand how that process would take place. And so we're there, and in this process, you start out by saying, okay, God, now's the time. And then a little further, you're saying, hello up there, you know, this is important. To the point to where even Michelle began to say, God, why? Why? Because of this pain that never goes away. And the affliction begins to change your perspective in terms of what's a blessing. The affliction did not look like a blessing to us in any way. Finally, after about 20 hours, and our doctor, knowing how hesitant I had been and Michelle had been about any emergency procedures, finally I began to suggest to him that maybe it was time. And now he's backing me off because he didn't want me to be pressuring him afterwards that we hadn't tried every available thing. And about the time I grabbed him by the neck, he began to understand that I had changed my mind, that I wanted this baby taken, that Michelle was beginning to fade and I could see it and something was not right. And so they wheeled her in. One of the agreements we had was that if there was indeed a need for an operation, that I would be there. And by that time, they wanted to make sure that I was not there, because that didn't seem to be a positive association in their mind. So they tucked me off in a little room and then headed down the hall and locked the door behind them as they went in to surgery. And it seemed to me at that moment in time that everything we had tried for, prayed about, dreamed about, planned, had all just absolutely gone down the wash. nothing that we had imagined had seemed to come that way and work out, and it was the opposite. And now they were cutting open Michelle, and I was alone there without being able to see what was taking place. And I sat down in the waiting room, and I just cried. I remember just sitting there, dropping my head and just crying, sobbing, that nothing seemed to have worked in the end in this, in what we had planned and hoped. When they brought Megan in after surgery and Michelle was in recovery and we had a chance to begin to talk to the doctor, we found out why it was that there had been a complication of this type. Megan's head in the birth canal there was cocked to the side, and literally to the point to one side of the head was flat, still pretty flat. But you know, with babies like that, their heads pop out real well after a while. And so we were always blowing on her ears and stuff to see if we could get it to pop out. But the side of her head was actually flat from the head being pushed so hard into the bone structure there. And she simply could not deliver in that way. It was not possible for that delivery now to take place. But there was another issue, because as they took her out, what they found was a condition they call partial placenta accretion. The placenta would not have disengaged in a normal manner and would have torn as the baby was delivered. And when that happens, a hemorrhage of bleeding begins immediately in a place where you cannot put direct pressure on the wound. And so you have a serious emergency at that moment in time, where the woman begins to hemorrhage blood and you don't have an immediate way to stop the flow. And they have to recognize it, and they have to get you in, and they have to open you up anyway to stop that hemorrhage of blood and to save that woman's life. After we got a chance to walk through the crisis, see what had taken place, it was very obvious to us that God was protecting my wife and our baby and me all along. At 6 hours, when I thought, well, this isn't too bad. At 12 hours, when I was beginning to wonder what's going on. At 18, when I thought God must be busy with somebody else. He was protecting us all along. Now, I don't know exactly how all these things work out. God sure could have healed the placenta, partial placenta accretion. I'm not a doctor, all right? And he could have straightened the head and healed the other, but for whatever reason, he chose to intercede in that way. And he wanted, I'm sure, to see, one, what's Mark going to do? What's Michelle going to do? I'm with you. Do you believe it? I'm bringing you out of affliction. I didn't call you to destruction. I called you to serve me. If you've had some trials or tests, that's okay. There's purpose in trials and tests, but that doesn't mean I've abandoned you. That doesn't mean I'm not there to see you through. I am on your side. Trust me. I'm God. You're the human. Look to me. It was a remarkable circumstance. Just because we're in pain doesn't mean that God isn't there. He may be allowing that pain for a reason. As we face hardships on the way to Canaan, in that sense, the promised land, ultimately the kingdom of God, we must not forget what it was really like to live in Egypt. The bread of affliction was a reminder that God went in and pulled them out of their affliction quickly in haste to bring them to Him, and they were supposed to remember it for the rest of their lives. What it had been like to be under bondage, and what indeed God's blessings really were. Israel turned around and reversed it right away, and did it time and time and time again. Look back in the book of Exodus. Exodus 3. When you see here God talking to Moses, that he had seen the affliction of his people and that he was ready now to deliver them. I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. He knew their sorrows. He knew their affliction, and he was waiting until the time to fulfill his plan in bringing them out. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and large land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites. And he mentions all these tribes who lived in the land. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Bringing them out of Egypt was God's mercy and his blessing and his protection. And so Moses went off as he was given instruction and went to Pharaoh. And as a result of that, at least from Israel's perspective, their burden was increased. They had to make just as many bricks as before, but now they had to go get their own straw. And because they were getting their own straw, they fell behind their allotment, and some of them then were beaten. Some of them then indeed feared for their lives. And from their perspective, obeying God was not a blessing, but rather a curse. And the affliction was the absence of God's leadership, not his protection. Go to verse 5, chapter 5, verse 22. Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it you have sent me? Moses goes and questions God. He says, for since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and neither have you delivered your people at all. God, I came to serve you. You said it was a blessing. It has been trial and test, and you have not kept your word. And God says, Moses, I am on your side. I am protecting you all along. In the midst of labor, sometimes we don't see that process taking place. But we need to be reminded that God has not called us to destruction. God has called us to mercy and grace. And we see that, but sometimes we see it more clearly looking back. In faith, brethren, we need to see it clearly looking forward as well. What obstacles have each of us faced in order to obey God? They probably look like mountains when we faced them. And after we walked through them, they probably look like hills. That's how these things work. When I was up a few weeks back with Steve and Kenny, his brother-in-law, up on Mount Adams, you know, when you're up there on the mountain, you're tired, and the storm clouds are blowing up over the ridge and you're not yet in camp, and you're trying to work your way up and set yourself up, and it looked to me like a mountain. Now, not Mount Adams, literally a mountain. It looked like standing before some great obstacle that I just wasn't sure how in the world you even walked through it. Now, the next morning, when we had broken camp and weathered that night and walked on down the mountain, and I got warm food in my belly, or full and thirsty, or my thirst is quenched, and the wind is up there, and I'm down here, and I began to ask myself, what was so bad about that? What was it about that that to me looked so imposing when we got up and walked out of there, and I look back, it simply didn't seem as big as it had been. Brethren, we sometimes, our fears look like mountains. But after, in our obedience to God, we face those fears and walk through them, and we look back, we find indeed that in many respects they simply were small little hills. And God walks us through those things. Satan knows where we are weak. He knows where it is that we will hesitate. He knows if we are willing to compromise in any specific way. And if we are, then he will absolutely guarantee that process of testing be put in place, and we will face it for the rest of our lives. If we do not walk through those things, trusting God, then effectively Satan will make that obstacle look so large that we will want to go back to Egypt. We will look at our blessings as a curse, and we will look at our bondage indeed as a blessing that used to be. It is a perversion of the mind that Satan fosters, and we must never submit ourselves to that. God called Israel out of Egypt to serve him, to bless them, and to prosper and increase them in many ways. And it was the limitation in their own mind that caused them to turn back. Chapter 6, God reminds Moses, don't worry, Moses, I have it under control. Then the Lord said to Moses, Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. And God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Lord. Moses, I'm okay, I'm in charge, I've got the power, I created you, I can handle this. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, Lord, I was not known to them. I have also established my covenant with them to give the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage in which they were strangers. He's reminding Moses that he's good to his word, that he made an agreement, that he made a covenant, that he made a promise, and that he will surely carry it out. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. I know they're in trouble. That's why I'm bringing them out of there. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and great judgments. I will take you as my people. I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I'll bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Lord. And Israel didn't believe him. They didn't believe him. Verse 9. So Moses spoke thus to the children of Israel, but they would not heed Moses because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage, because they focused on the moment of the affliction. They did not believe, indeed, that God was there to help them, to save them, and to bring them out. God had a greater purpose for Israel than just making them comfortable, and it's the same way with us. God is not here just to make us feel good, and he didn't call us so that we would just have everything just so. There is a purpose in affliction. There is benefit to trial and test, and Christ showed us how to walk through that and how to do those things his way. Have you ever thought, why did Christ have to suffer as much as he did? Not just suffer, but suffer as much as he did. You know, why couldn't he just suffer a little less and it would be sufficient? Why couldn't Christ, say, save his blood up in a blood bank until he'd get a bunch, and then when the time came, he could just give that blood and shed it on the altar and forgive our sins? Because it wasn't complete until it included his death. And so Christ suffered, but in suffering, he also learned from it. And he walked before us by example. In Hebrews 5, it portrays, in some respects, the benefits of suffering, that Christ actually had to walk through it in that specific way. Hebrews 5, verse number 5. Says, Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, You are my son, today I have begotten you. As he also says in another place, You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications, with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and was heard because of his godly fear. So Christ is suffering, and he's in affliction, and he's crying out just deeply and intimately to God to intercede on his behalf in this way. He says, though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him, called by God as high priest, according to the order of Melchizedek. He walked through before us and showed us that there is purpose in the suffering and the trials indeed that we face. Psalm 119 describes some of the benefits of our affliction. Some of the reason why that we should be able to try and strive to still keep our focus on God and truly to trust him as we walk in that way. Psalm 119, verse 65. There's a section of a passage here that reinforces this in a very specific way. long, long chapter here, Psalm 119, 65. You have dealt well with your servant. Now, when I think of dealt well, I think of, well, you've protected me, you've increased me, you've enriched me, you've forgiven me, you've been patient with me, dealt well with your servant. But notice the context. You've dealt well with your servant, O Lord, according to your word. Teach me good knowledge and, good judgment and knowledge, for I believe your commandments. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. You have dealt well with your servant, because before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. You brought me back to you, and you allowed me to suffer enough so that my focus would get back in place. You are good and do good. Teach me your statutes. 71, it is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I may learn your statutes. The law of your mouth is better to me than thousands of shekels of gold and silver. Verse 75, I know, O Lord, that your judgments are right, and that in faithfulness you have afflicted me. The bread of affliction was to represent the fact that Israel had been oppressed and that God had indeed allowed them to suffer, but he was now going to intervene and intercede and bring them to him. And that they should always remember what it was like to be in bondage and what indeed it would be like now to be free. That God had brought them to him and protected them, but he corrected and rebuked them so that they might learn to obey, so that they might serve him properly. One of the lessons that we learn through affliction is how to comfort each other when we suffer as well. When Alan and I were going out on Monday to spend the day with his family, and as we're heading out the door, Nancy called the home, and Megan was home, and I was at Alan's, and Megan called over to Alan's house and said that Velma had gone down into the hospital and that Velma was having some problems. And so as we headed out of town, we swung by and saw her. Velma couldn't remember why she was in the hospital. She couldn't remember calling the hospital or talking to Nancy. She couldn't remember talking about, one of the last things she had told Nancy is, well, I got some desserts and I want to make sure they get there for the dinner. And of course, she's going to go be sick in the hospital, but they wanted to make the desserts get to where everybody else could enjoy. But we're there in the hospital and Velma could only remember the present moment. She couldn't remember last minute or 2 minutes. She could just remember that little bit, and we were talking. So through the day, Alan and I, as we spoke, we were praying for Velma to get back and trying to get back, and it was 11 o'clock as we came back through the other way. The hospital was pretty quiet, and lights were down, and we went ahead and went up just to take a chance to see how she was doing, because we were quite concerned with her condition from that morning. And we're standing in the hall outside her room, and the nurse goes in and checks, and she's asleep, and comes back out and says, I'm sorry, she's asleep. And I says, okay. So we're talking real low, and then Velma, she was faking it. No, she had her eyes closed, and she hears my voice and recognizes it, and she calls out and says, oh, please, come in. And so Alan and I walk in, and, we're talking to her, and she's a little stronger, and she could remember through the day and the tests, and we're there literally a couple of minutes, and Velma says, you guys need to go home. It's late. You need some rest. Don't stay here. And I mean, she's in the hospital. We're visiting her, and she was concerned about us. She was concerned about Alan and his father and the family, and she was very deeply touched that his father had died and what he must be going through. Why does Velma know how to have compassion? Because she has suffered herself. And she was suffering. And she understood what it was like to lose your father or family member. She understood what it was like to be gone and tired and late and trying to take care of things and prepare for the holy day. She honestly, as she laid there in the hospital, was concerned about us. And I thought that that was remarkable. We walk out of there going, wow, we're here to help her, and she's making sure that, you know, we're okay. I thought it was dramatic. We should learn to be sensitive to each other's pain by suffering ourselves. That kind of understanding, frankly, just doesn't come in any other way. In the book of 2 Corinthians, chapter 1, verse number 3, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort. God here being portrayed as all mercy and comfort. And as you're sitting there suffering and in labor and waiting for the birth of the child, he's still the God of mercy and all comfort. And whatever God is doing, indeed, if we've submitted ourselves to him, is to do something that is indeed for our own good, because we are part of him and he is in us, because he called us, and because he will not indeed turn aside in any way. The God of all comfort, the Father of mercies, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. We suffer, God intercedes for us, he comforts us, and we learn then to understand that process, and we comfort each other as well. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, which would obviously mean life's not always the greatest, so our consolation also abounds through Christ. Now, if we are afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation. Paul now speaking about them trying to ministerially serve and care for the Corinthians, which is effective for enduring the same sufferings which we also suffer. Or if we are comforted, it is for your consolation and salvation. And our hope for you is steadfast, because we know that as you are partakers of the sufferings, so also you will partake of the consolation. It's an incredible process, brethren, that God walks us through, draws us into, leads us by. As we walk through this life, we suffer in various ways, and in so we learn a lesson to where we are able to better understand and assist and help each other. We sacrifice in this life to obey God. God wants us to understand that process. He doesn't want it to be simple and easy, because he wants us to be convicted and to put him first no matter what. And he turns and he blesses us in many, many ways. When Michelle was pregnant with Megan and we began to prepare for the birth, things are a little tighter as you begin to change your life in that way. You're preparing the house, and there's things to buy, and there's needs that you'll have for the child that's coming, and money begins to go out the door. There's going to be medical expenses and various bills you'll have to pay, and you begin to start to try to strive to set some of that aside. And so, frankly, financially, things tightened up a little bit as we approached that time. But we had wanted a child for years. It had been 7 years from when we were married until Michelle was pregnant. And I've expressed that in other sermons, how Michelle's womb was closed, and how then God miraculously interceded and opened her womb and granted us a child. But we wanted to give God thanks in a specific way for granting us our child. And so we decided to prepare an offering, which to us was our first fruit offering, our first child. And so we thought, well, okay, we will prepare the offering, and we will just give it then to God. And we ended up giving it on the first day of unleavened bread, this day, back then, in this case, 1989. We had saved incrementally during that pregnancy a sum of money, which we then offered to God again as our gratefulness and what we considered our first fruits back to him in that way. What was remarkable to us and was totally unexpected, but an incredible act of mercy, was God gave us all of the offering back the very next day with a significant increase as well. You cannot outgive God. You'll never be more merciful than God. You'll never be more understanding than God, more compassionate than God. You know, we can cut any corner we want. Israel cut them all. Israel cut it to the point to where bad looked good and good looked bad. They simply didn't have the faith. Joshua thought it looked good to go forward. Israel thought it looked best to go back. But God says, well, sorry, but I'm going that way. Which way do you want to go? Because I was a minister, and this was not something that we had been aware of, one of the doctors had done the C-section. Obviously, we started out with a couple $1,000 or $1,500 birth, and now we have a $10,000 birth because of the surgery and the operation and the anesthesia and all of these things. It was just all of these expenses that ballooned up at that time. And we were looking at this pile of now medical expense, even after insurance, that was going to be left over and in place. And I don't remember exactly what started it, but the doctor who had done the surgery on that let us know, and it was the day after the first day of unleavened bread, the very next day. I'm a minister, and he actually extended what he considered like a professional courtesy. He says, well, you know, you work here and you help in the hospitals, and he says, I'll just, for my charges, I'm going to take just insurance only, and I'll write off the rest that remains. And then the anesthesiologist did that, and then it went right on down through the system, and every single person involved wrote off all the additional expense, and that birth did not cost us, beyond what insurance covered, a penny. And it was far more than what we had in our sacrifice given to God just the day before. I don't believe for a minute it was a coincidence. I don't believe for a minute it just happened. I believe God in His mercy and His love and His care said, all right, you have taken circumstance here that to you look like risk, but I want you to know that there's purpose in this. One, I protected your daughter. I spared your wife. And I have returned to you your gift, not only that, but much more. I don't want to ever forget that. I don't want Derek to ever forget that there was no more debris and no more pieces of bamboo in his eye when God healed him at that point. I don't ever want to forget that members of the congregation here prayed for Derek and the pressure went down in 4 hours later when the eye began to clear and the deposits began to break up. Derek's bad eye now is stronger than his good eye. The astronaut who died that was from Spokane, they had articles in the paper. He died in on the shuttle explosion. And so I'm reading through the articles in the paper, and here's a young man when he was a kid who wanted to be a pilot and he wanted to be an astronaut. So he wears goggles when he mows the lawn as a teenager because he knows he has to have those eyes if he's going to do what his life dream is going to do. He protected those eyes. Derek wants to be a pilot. Derek wants to fly. He wants to do other things with aerospace that might be available to him. And God could only return that to him with his eyes. Are we grateful? I'm deeply grateful. I don't ever want to forget it. Was it an affliction indeed when he poked that stick right in there and it stuck on the eye and bounced out and left debris and pieces of fiber sticking in there? It surely was. God was with us. Does that mean God always removes our pain? He certainly does not. Does that mean God will always make us well? Obviously, He does not. But He chooses that for our good. He chooses to intercede and to what degree to intercede so that we might learn to serve before Him. Our affliction is not for naught. It is for our good purpose and service to God. When we're eating unleavened bread, it is still bread. It is still food. It is nurture, and it portrays for us what God has intended for us to learn. This birth process that we walk through indeed can be painful. And the closer we get to its completion, the more painful it can become. It does seem at times to go on forever, but just like a birth, all of a sudden, bang, it's over, it's gone, it's done. And it's always fascinated me, especially with the women. They suffer the most, and they remember it the least. It is a huge mountain when you're walking through the pain of the labor, waiting for the child to deliver. It is a little tiny hill in the distance when you walk out the other side and carry on. Michelle just doesn't remember the pain as being quite as dramatic. I remember it worse than she. And I didn't even have to walk through it firsthand. I was an observer. In our life, the trials before us are often mountains. When we trust God and walk through them, and we look back, in many respects, they just seem like hills. They are gone. God works with our minds in those specific ways. Paul said, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. This is the days of unleavened bread, brethren. It is a great blessing to walk through the symbolism and to understand what God has put in place. We must, in the process, remember where God called us out of, where we have come from. We know where we are, but we must focus indeed on where we're going. We are walking out of Egypt in that sense, but we must keep our focus on the promises ahead. We must keep our focus on God.